It's a great pleasure to talk with the pianist Yefim Bronfman, our first opportunity to do this, although he has been before the public now, well, he's now in his fourth decade of astonishing audiences, critics, and musicians with his artistry and his mastery both of technique and interpretation when it comes to the keyboard, to the piano, his instrument. We had the opportunity to speak with him while he was in town to perform the Rachmaninoff Third Piano Concerto with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and Nemi Yarvi, a combination that came about as a very last-minute substitution for one of 2 weeks that were to be led by Ricardo Chailly, long absent from Chicago, but Chailly had to undergo some health tests back in Europe, and fortunately, this combination of the veteran conductor Nemi Yarvi and the marvelous and seemingly making himself available to Chicago more than usual, and we're happy for that, pianist Yefim Bronfman came together. So it's a great opportunity to catch up with this artist and to talk with him about his past and current projects. Welcome, Yefim Bronfman.
Thank you. Great to be here.
People have a tendency to speak of you as, quote-unquote, a Russian pianist, or perhaps because you're not tiny, you're not overly big looking at you up front, but to talk always of your power and your force and your ferocity. But in fact, while you're perfectly capable of playing loud, if the score says fortissimo, you play as well in other volumes, and you play, in fact, perhaps with some of the finest filigree delicacy that I know of anybody playing today. Does it burden you at all to be stereotyped in these ways?
I think to call me a Russian pianist is a myth, because I'm anything but Russian. You know, I was not even born in Russia. I was born in Uzbekistan.
Mm-hmm. Though it was then a part of the Soviet Union.
Soviet Union, but the Soviet Union is not Russia.
It's
you know, I'm big, yes. But although I have must very proud to say that I've lost 30 pounds over the last 3-4 months. At the order of my doctors.
Yes,
so,
yes.
You know, I play wide range repertoire. I studied in Moscow. I always think how my life would turn out to be if I, let's say, studied with the same teacher for 15 years in Moscow, and then I would be called, certainly I would be entitled to the title Russian pianist. But I actually left Soviet Union when I was 14, and I studied with a teacher in Israel who had a European education. And then when I came to this country, I studied with Rudolf Serkin, with whom I mainly studied German repertoire.
Right.
And then I studied with Leon Fleischer.
Right.
The same thing. It was only on occasions, rare occasions, I would come and play for him Russian music.
In fact, I think the only person that you worked with or were associated with as a kid who came out of a Russian tradition, but who wasn't Russian per se, was the violinist Isaac Stern. Everyone else was coming out of a continental tradition that you worked with.
Even he was never playing Russian repertoire. You know, I tried to play, I once asked him to play Prokofiev Violin Sonata, which he agreed reluctantly.
Mm-hmm.
It was my series in New York. I did one time. It was Schumann Prokofiev series. And I asked him to play Prokofiev. He really wasn't happy about it, but he did it anyway.
I guess I was thinking more Russian style than Russian repertoire, but even that's a stretch because he wasn't your piano teacher anyway.
You know, it depends how you associate the Russian. I think that for me, of course, some of the greatest pianists come from Russia. Like my heroes are Gilels and Richter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those are really the pianists that I admire the most.
Right.
They're such incredible, masters. We forget how great they are until I watch a lot of videos of these people. And it's really unbelievable, to see Richter recital from Moscow Conservatory. It's mind-boggling with such energy and dedication and commitment to the music. Whether it's Beethoven or Rachmaninoff, it's unbelievable. You don't hear that kind of playing anymore.
Right. Just as it was something of a tragedy that more people couldn't see him while he was alive. It's an incredible boon, one of the sides of technology that is good, that we now can see, not just see him playing, but see so many, many things that were recorded. It's really quite astonishing how many things were filmed or captured on video of him playing.
Well, I guess the people in Moscow are very good about filming these recitals. You know, they're all very primitive. They are all stationed, you know, the two cameras, black and white. But it doesn't matter. But the energy and the colors you hear are still there.
Still come across.
And you also Gilels, you know.
Right.
And there is, recently I've seen Richter and Rostropovich play all the Beethoven sonatas from Edinburgh Festival, you know, on video, which is
I have not yet seen that video, but I mean, of course, that's the classic combination for the audio recording of those works.
It's stunning. I mean, it's really two young giants. I mean, relatively speaking, they play, Rostropovich plays everything by memory, of course.
Right.
Or to see Oistrakh play, well, we shouldn't be talking about those instruments, but talking pianists now.
Yeah, but that's still, the point is, we'll come back to that. These things are related. But I have to mention something else, and that is where the prop is really kicked out of the myth that there is a Russian cast to what you do. And that is that I read recently, I think in the Los Angeles Times, that you only began playing perhaps the Russian piano concerto, the first Tchaikovsky, very recently, and you only even began looking at it about 5 years ago.
Yes, it's absolutely true. It's I think I do everything backwards. you know, the same Prokofiev sonatas, you know, I didn't really learn most of them until I was asked to make a recording of them. You know, it's just something I was staying away from, except for maybe 7 and 8 sonatas. I haven't really known them, you know, until, so it took me a while to
get some of that, the Prokofiev, we can come back to that too. The Prokofiev, of course, his reputation, his repertoire has come in and out of style, come in and out of vogue. But the Tchaikovsky, I mean, this is something kids even learn for competitions. I mean, was it just you thought it's overdone or you had nothing to add to it or it didn't speak to you?
It just came late. You know, I didn't realize, you know, I'm glad I've realized it now that Tchaikovsky was such a genius. Mm-hmm. He was really the greatest Russian composer of all times. And one of the greatest composers. I discovered him quite late, unfortunately. You know, now I...
Do you think you had a mental block about him?
I had
because
a mental block.
It was so Russian or so popular? Or
I tell you when the block began. When I was about 8 years old, my parents took me to listen to Tchaikovsky competition in Moscow. And I must have listened to 8 or 10 Tchaikovsky concerts played. Really not so good. Even then I could tell the difference.
Sure.
So maybe that when the mental block began that I really don't want to play it because it sounds so bad. It sounds like, you know, like anything else. If it's not played, it doesn't sound like good music.
Right.
It could be Beethoven concerto, you know, it doesn't matter. That's when I suspect my best professional opinion that's the mental block has begun. And, you know, many years went by. And then my friend Marius Janssens, conductor, asked, so you should really, he told me, you really should play Tchaikovsky concerto. Why don't you come and play with me in Pittsburgh? So I thought, well, why give it a try? And that's where I played it for the first time, the Pittsburgh Symphony and Marius Janssens about five years ago. And I absolutely fell in love with the piece immediately. I thought it's just one of the greatest pieces ever written.
It provides an interesting case study, I guess, because there must be relatively few examples of somebody who is already so far into an important and distinguished career taking those abilities and applying them to adding to his repertoire a staple work. And perhaps that gave you even some advantages to look at the work in a fresh way at this point in your career rather than as a student.
That's how I like to look at it. And I must say that every time I play it, for me, it's such an exciting event.
Yeah.
I regret not learning it because, you know, when you learn something young, it's... It just seems more natural.
Sure.
But from the other hand, you know, I don't take it for granted. I think for me, every note is very meaningful, and I I just practiced it now before our meeting, because I'm playing it in Asia with such a great excitement. You know, I really love looking at the phrase and changing it, and this, I mean, it's something that only happens to new pieces in your repertory, and then I'm, you know, thrilled to play it.
On the other hand, perhaps the other staple Russian work, the Rachmaninoff Third, which has been with you throughout your professional career, your performances here have been completely fresh and completely alive.
Well, that's, as a performer, that's my goal, is to make sure that it's never is a routine experience. You know, it can be difficult. You know, certain pieces I don't play anymore.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the pieces you've retired?
Second concerto,
yes.
Rachmaninoff. Mm-hmm. I retired because I simply couldn't deal with it anymore. For somehow, it's my problem. It's that piece is great. Mm-hmm. Or Franck Violin Sonata.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I just don't want to play it. Yeah. You know, it's somehow I ran out of ideas. Some of the great pieces, you know, interesting, some Mozart, Beethoven, never happened.
You never learned?
Never happened that I got tired of it.
Ah, that you never got tired
of it. Every time I pick up a Mozart concerto, let's say, I discover something new.
Right.
And that's what's exciting about this music. But, you know, when I pick up Rachmaninoff's second concerto a couple of times, there's nothing I can do anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, that's it.
But that's an important thing, isn't it, for an artist to be able to say, this is right for me now and this is not right for me now. Otherwise, you're a machine.
Absolutely. I think I think we have the right to choose a repertoire up to a certain point. I think it's also our duty to play and commit yourself to music that sometimes you don't love. I think it's you don't love it at the moment. It's not because the music is not good. It's because you're not good. Mm. Because I'm not good enough.
What are some examples for you?
Scrabin, for instance. Mm-hmm. You know, I have never really had an impulse to play it. Mm-hmm. I love listening to it, but somehow I just never could get into it as a performer.
Mm-hmm. You know? But you feel that someday you should take
it on. I must,
on.
Yes. I must, because it's part of growth. It's when artist is always a student.
Another aspect of that perspective for you, well, perspective is a good word, because one of the places you've done this is the Perspectives series at Carnegie Hall. But you're an artist who not only likes to play various types of music, but to put various things together and even to curate programs where you might not even be playing. I mean, do you see that as a part of your role as an artist, or is that your role as an enthusiast and as a listener?
I see myself very often as a collaborator. I love to collaborate with people. I love to work with other people. For instance, composers. I'm very happy to have premiered two of the great young composers in my Perspective series, which is Jörg Wittmann, mm-hmm. the German young composer, and Marc-André Delbavy.
Mm-hmm. Well-known here in Chicago.
And, you know, what's exciting for me that I can actually work with these people and talk to them before they write the piece. Mm-hmm. So it's very...
All those questions you might have had for Tchaikovsky or Rachmaninoff, you can ask Wittmann and Delbavy in a way.
Exactly. I never tell them what to write, but I want to make sure that they know my playing. And when Wittmann heard me once in Vienna, he went to hear me, and he said he got an inspiration to write something different for me, because from the sound that he heard.
So what did he hear when you say you want them to know your playing? If I were to ask Jörg Wittmann, what do you think he would tell me about your playing?
He was mentioning that I was rehearsing, actually came to rehearsal that I had with Vienna Philharmonic and Pierre Boulez conducting. Mm-hmm. Mozart concerto.
There's a combination.
Which we were...
Boulez, Bronfen, and Vienna in a Mozart concerto.
Yes, which we were playing in Salzburg Festival a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. And he came to rehearsal and he said that he heard such wonderful soft colors and that he gave him inspiration to write something special for me, which he did. Mm-hmm. It's a masterpiece that he wrote called 11 Humoresques.
Mm-hmm. It's a solo work?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Marvelous piece.
And what is the piece that Marc-André Delbavy
wrote
for you?
He wrote a trio for me, Gil Shaham and Lynn Harrell, which we premiered also in Carnegie Hall.
Yes.
It's a marvelous trio.
Oh, it'd be wonderful to hear that here.
I hope one day to bring it here.
Yes. And, of course, we did see you also play the piano concerto of Esa-Pekka Salonen.
Esa-Pekka Salonen is a altogether a different kind of collaboration, which began 20 years ago when I first... in 1990, I worked with him for the first time, which was a recording session of the Rachmaninoff's second and third piano concertos. That was our first collaboration.
Right.
Which became... very strong collaboration. It's interesting that last weekend I was in Los Angeles and somebody from the department told me that I have performed with Esa-Pekka in his tenure over 60 times.
Really?
In Los Angeles.
Yes.
Which is a stunning number.
Yes, right.
You know, for one performer.
Right.
And, you know, looking back, you know, the Bartek project recording and the Shostakovich concertos, and everything else we've played, you know, and then his piano concerto. It's added up to a very respectful number, you know, of performances.
But some of that does make some sense because, I mean, you're almost exact contemporaries.
We are, exactly.
And you're 50, and yes. You both are in many ways omnivorous in terms of interests. Maybe you don't play everything, but you listen to so much and you're curious about so many things, and you both believe in I don't want to say it in any kind of a, at all, in any kind of a cheap way, but you both aim for a certain kind of aliveness and excitement in performance.
Thank you. You know, for me, Esa-Pekka is a very important part of my musical life. I admire him for bringing so much interesting music to an orchestra. He brought so many interesting people, not only composers, conductor, and pianist and violinist, but also stage directors and opera directors. He was really... I love the way his mind works. Mm-hmm. And I love the way he writes music. And, you know, I love the fact that he had me in mind when he wrote the piano concerto.
Right. You certainly, listening to that piece, which I was privileged to do a couple of times and to write about it, I think I mentioned in there, it's almost hard to imagine yet anyone else playing the piece because it's written both for you and for your skills.
Well, it was too hard, too hard. I was complaining bitterly for a few weeks before the premiere, but survived somehow.
We're speaking with Yefim Fima Bronfman, the great pianist based in New York City, but known really all over the world. Are there any places that you haven't played yet that you would like to be playing? I mean, I know there are probably some countries you haven't played in because they don't have concert series. But.
Well, you know, my I play in Europe a lot. I play in America a lot. I go to Japan regularly. Mm-hmm. Recently, I was in Australia and New Zealand for the first time.
Yes.
You know, Asian, as I mentioned before, I go to Singapore and Hong Kong next week. Mm-hmm. Actually, this week, tomorrow,
right.
I'm leaving.
We're speaking now in late October.
Yeah, yes. With Esa-Pekka Salonen and the Los Angeles Orchestra for a little tour. You know, I would love to see culture spread other places. Mm-hmm. You know, I would love to go play in Damascus and in... Tehran and, mm-hmm. you know, but it's right now it's only dreaming.
Yeah. You do play in Jerusalem because you participated in Elena Bashkirova's Jerusalem International Chamber Music
several
Festival.
Times. And I also play regularly with Israel Philharmonic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Every year I go with a very good collaboration with Zubin Mehta. I've made some recordings there. And
with whom you made your debut, I think,
that's
at least
right.
in this country, right?
Yes.
32 years ago.
With Bernstein conducting.
Yes.
Bernie Hall.
Yes. Yes.
So I have a good relationship with that orchestra, and I go practically every year, sometimes twice a year.
And there are, at least on the music front, some exciting things happening in that region where musicians, particularly young musicians from the different countries, have been coming together and playing and touring, but not yet to the point where Israeli musicians can publicly play in the Arab countries or in Iran.
I hope it will happen in our lifetimes, you know.
Yeah, I hope so, too.
It would be very exciting. I'd love to go to China. Mm-hmm. I only been to mainland China once. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, I did a festival where I've played the Bartok two piano sonata with Marta Argerich.
Oh, wow. Is there a video of that? That must be something.
I am sure there is a video of that, but I have to get a hold of it. It was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. What are you working on now, in addition to works from your repertoire that you are
right now touring? Actually, speaking of Tchaikovsky, I am working on his piano sonata in G major, which is not played, to my knowledge, very often at all, and I'm really hoping to play it next year in recitals.
Did this grow out of your learning the piano concerto?
Yes, it sort of grew out of my fascination with Tchaikovsky, and also I'm planning to learn his second concerto. Mm-hmm. I think it's a masterpiece. Yes. It's a tremendous concerto, and it's not programmed that often.
Right.
Certainly it's not part of standard repertory in any orchestra, to my knowledge. So Tchaikovsky piano sonata is a fantastic piece. It's quite long. It's probably 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful Pletnyov recording. Mm-hmm. And there's somewhere a Richter recording also. Mm-hmm. And having read some of the memoirs of Prokofiev, he used to play it in his recitals. He loved the piece.
Yes.
But he changed the ending.
Uh-huh.
So he wrote, there is a Prokofiev ending to this.
Uh-huh.
Because he thought it was not as effective as it should be, which is probably right. But so I'm trying to get hold of that ending because it'd be interesting to see what he did.
And maybe even try both of them out.
Yes.
Yes.
So this is the piece for my next year recital program. Mm-hmm. A great Finnish composer, Magnus Lindberg, is writing me a solo piece for Carnegie Hall.
He's a very exciting composer.
Exciting composer, yes.
Now, you're also going to be in Chicago with another wonderful pianist, slightly older than you, in two piano, or is it four hands, or is it both?
Well, we cannot fit in the same piano. So we have to still play two pianos. Yeah, that's coming in a couple of weeks.
How did this come about, and how did you select the repertoire?
Well, I have known Emmanuel for many years. You know, he was really one of my first friends when I came to America. I've always been an admirer of his. And he is my neighbor now. We live in the same building.
Okay. Makes rehearsal scheduling a little easier.
Well, we actually go to rehearse in Juilliard or in Steinway's, because both of us have two pianos, but they're all in different rooms.
I see. But at least you catch each other in the elevator to remind each other that you have to practice.
We always meet downstairs in the lobby and we take subway to Juilliard or whatever.
Yeah. And how did you pick the repertoire for the recital?
Repertory, it's we've done, this is maybe the third or fourth tour in a period of 10 years. So in this period, we have accumulated quite a repertoire. So we have brought back two old pieces that we've played and recorded together, which is Rachmaninoff's Symphonic Dances and Brahms' Variations. Mm-hmm. Mozart Sonata is new for me. Mm. I'm playing it for the first time.
Interesting.
Yeah. He has played it, I assume, several times.
Yes.
And the Bolkom is new for both of us.
Right.
Bolkom we picked because it's also dances, and I think it has a nice correlation to the Symphonic Dances by Rachmaninoff. It's very different. It's a very fun three dances in South American style. I think, that's how it came about.
Great. Are there some composers, there must be, who didn't write for the piano or didn't write much for the piano that you wish had written for the piano based on how you feel about their other music?
Well, Berlioz, because I love Berlioz. Right. For me, he's one of the greatest composers.
That makes sense.
Has a great language, and I wish he wrote something if he did write something for the piano, it would be very exciting.
It would have been, yeah. He would have had to first learn how to play it, unfortunately. But yes, that is interesting. Wouldn't it be something if we had a Berlioz concerto or a giant Berlioz sonata?
Even not so much Wagner, I mean, because Wagner is what he wrote and, Liszt made some transcriptions. Yes. So at least we have that.
Right.
But it would be great to have Romeo and Juliet by Berlioz on the piano. And I think it's such a beautiful piece. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think, I don't know if anybody made the transcription of it for piano, but I think it would be very exciting.
Yes, yes. Maybe somebody listening out there
it's one of the most exciting pieces.
We'll get to work on that. And what conductors who are either no longer working or no longer living do you wish that you might have collaborated with in terms of concerto work?
Well, I have the right to look back. I'm 50.
Yes.
The people I remember with great affection is, of course, Bernstein.
Sure.
With whom I had a fortune to work with. Unfortunately, I was too young to appreciate his genius. Mm-hmm. But he was a very exciting figure, you know. I mean, now looking back and remembering his concerts in New York, you know, you don't have anything like that, of that kind of excitement. And
right.
Even if it was terrible, but it was still always special, always right. unique.
Right.
And, you know, the Mahler that he did, you know, whether it was... Some people claim it was Bernstein, was not Mahler, but it doesn't matter. I think it was something very exciting. I'll never forget, I went to a rehearsal and I heard him do second Mahler symphony. That was one of the greatest experiences of my young life.
To attend the rehearsal.
Yes. It was just something never to forget, you know.
This kind combination of encyclopedic knowledge, technical ability and complete charisma is very rare to have any of those things, but to have them all together.
It was more than charisma, it was magnetism, you know, in stunning proportions.
Yeah.
You know, I very often remember although very different kind of a conductor, but, you know, with the tremendous knowledge and with whom I actually worked here in Chicago, as far as I remember, is Erich Leinsdorf.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because he was really, he engaged me a lot in the early 80s. He was, for some reason, he thought very highly of me. And I made a lot of debuts playing with major orchestra, like Boston Symphony debut. Mm-hmm. He engaged me to play in Symphony Hall, which, you know, very hard to get that kind of engagement for a young pianist.
Yes.
And he made me learn the Mozart Coronation Concerto for that. And it was... He was a big success, you know. For some reason, he was very smart with his repertoire. He wouldn't let me play Rachmaninoff or Liszt Concerto, but, you know, something different, and it worked.
It's interesting. Leinsdorf had that approach with orchestras, of course, in terms of the repertoire he put together, with soloists, as you're pointing out for us, and with audiences.
Yeah.
And probably with himself. He didn't want to bore anybody. He wanted to provoke, not by being a bad boy or something, but by saying, here's something you didn't know, and
that's
let's
right.
treat it with the same level that we would treat the things that you do know.
That's right. And, you know, when I play with him with New York Philharmonic, 2025 was really one of my first New York Philharmonic, he made me play Debussy Fantasy. Debussy Fantasy, at least Hungarian Fantasy in the same program.
So he really tried to find things that were going
and
to
you
challenge
know, it
you.
Was a big success, you know. Yeah. I mean, I've played with the Philharmonic. I played maybe a Prokofiev Third Concerto and all that, but this was somehow started as a new page in my career, you know.
Yeah.
So he was very clever. I still have his letters that he wrote me about some repertoire suggestions, you know, for recitals.
Oh,
it was very... I learned a lot from him. He was somebody that, unfortunately, my relationship was cut off prematurely. He got very upset at me for something, and then that was it. I never saw him again.
He had that side also.
He had that side of, you know, we were playing together in Long Island with New York Philharmonic. It was a Mozart concerto, I think, like 482, one of this. And he didn't like the fact that his name was not in my bio. So he never engaged me again.
What a shame.
Yeah,
well,
he's
listening down to the terrestrial world and hearing this interview.
Well, you know, but I do have tremendous respect for him.
Of course.
He had somebody I learned a lot from. Another conductor that, I mean, of course, he's still alive, and but he's retired from conducting, is Savalysh, with whom I loved playing. And he was a wonderful, uncompromising musician with whom I had great fortune working.
But in terms of overall style, so interesting. If you had to invent a conductor the opposite of Leonard Bernstein, it'd probably be Wolfgang. I mean, who was still great, it'd probably be Wolfgang Savalysh.
Yeah, of course. Or Dohnányi was whom I enjoy working with Dohnányi a lot. He's a wonderful musician, but completely different.
Yeah, yeah.
But I like, you know, I learned so much from this.
So playing music is about learning for you as much as it is about, quote-unquote, performing.
Well, what else can it be? I mean, I don't know everything, you know. So when I play with a conductor, you know, Barenboim or Simon Rattle, I learn something. I mean, those people know so much more than I do.
Yes.
You know.
What, if anything, that you can tell us about did you learn from this interesting collaboration with Boulez on Mozart in Salzburg?
It was remarkable. You know, it was... I always wanted to work with Boulez. It almost worked in a couple of places, but somehow never quite materialized. you know, he's just standing there and his presence, people want to play better. Mm-hmm. That's an unexplainable phenomenon.
Yes.
But, you know, he basically, you know, I think the better conductor, the more you're able to let the music speak for itself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's what he did.
Yes.
And it was remarkable. You know, it was one of the most beautiful, well, Vienna Philharmonic, of course, but they also played so beautifully, you know, all the... He just let them play, you know, he was just moderating it.
Mm-hmm. Yet he lets them play in a way that's not exactly the same way as they play with some of the other people who let
them
play.
For sure.
Let's put it that way.
For sure. I'm excited. Next summer I'm going to be playing with him in Lucerne Festival,
yes.
The Berg Camera Concert.
Ah, yes. Wow.
So I'm really excited to do that.
Yeah.
Because
going from Mozart to that with him will be very interesting terms of his core.
I think nobody knows this piece better than he does.
Yeah. Have you ever looked at his sonatas? Would you ever think you would try to play
one? I would
one
love
of them?
To. Yeah, I would love to. If I ever have time to learn it, I would love to play it.
You are known even in a field where people have to and do rehearse a lot, for rehearsing a lot, practicing a lot. You also travel in a field that people travel a lot. You travel a great deal in terms of time and in terms of mileage. But my understanding is that you also read a lot, and I'm just curious, what are some of the things you might be reading now?
Well, you know, I'm curious about literature, and I'm curious about, fascinated about autobiographies. Mm-hmm. In various languages also, not only in English but also in Russian and in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. Actually, very recently I read a wonderful book by Alex Ross.
Mm-hmm.
That The Rest is Noise.
Right.
I thought it was a very interesting book. I learned mm-hmm. a lot. There is a book I'm reading now called The Soloist.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a movie that came. Somebody gave it to me in Los Angeles, so
yes.
I'm almost done with that. It's a story about a homeless musician who, you know, black homeless musician who
right.
went to Juilliard. And
I read about it. I
yes.
can't recall.
And
the
my
author,
name is mentioned in the book in context that he went to a concert where I performed.
Interesting.
You know, my great uncle was actually a very well-known writer in Russia.
Yes.
He was contemporary of Babel.
Uh-huh. And his name was?
Gecht.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote some excellent books. Mm-hmm. You know, he was persecuted as a Jew. And mm-hmm. But... he lived in Odessa, and so the literature was always part of, you know, my parents always read a lot. My sister read a lot, so it's part of our life
yes.
at home
yes.
as a kid, you know. I'm you know, got into American literature, you know, slowly but surely. I came across, obvious people, but also... very recently, Philip Roth,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, in the year 2000, I was on tour with Philadelphia Orchestra in Europe, and so one of the players came to me and said, "Did you read the new book of Philip Roth, Human Stain?"
Yes.
I said, "No, I didn't," because it's written about you there, like the whole paragraph about you, two pages. I said, "What?" So she gave me the book.
Yes.
And, you know, a personality in that book goes to a rehearsal in Tanglewood, and sure enough, I play, and he
uh-huh.
describes me.
But you like the rest of the book, too, it
yes,
sounds
yes,
like.
I did. I've never heard of Philip Roth. You know,
yeah.
that's how. Then I read a lot of his book, and I actually met him.
I was going to say, did you meet him?
I met him very recently. It was, we had lunch together. It was... wonderful. And then he invited us for dinner, me and my girlfriend invited me for dinner on his side. And of course, we walked into a restaurant and everybody was looking at him, you know, people. He's so famous.
Right.
You know.
And he also doesn't go out a lot to restaurants and so on. He's usually at home working in Connecticut, I think.
Well, yeah, he has an apartment in New York.
Yeah.
And I asked him, it was like just in springtime. I asked him what he was writing, anything. He said, "No, nothing at the moment," because he just... when idea hits him, he starts writing.
Yeah.
But until that happens, it could few years could pass.
Yeah.
And then, he comes to concert. He came to my concert when I did the world premieres in May. We had dinner afterwards. Interesting, interesting guy.
That's an interesting combination. Well,
very smart. My God, his brains is...
We're glad to say he's a product of the University of Chicago. So
that's right. Yes,
that's an important connection. He even admits to that. So.
Yeah, that's.
Well, nothing that you say surprises me about things that are interesting and things that interest you, because Yefim Bronfman really is a mind as well as an artist and as well as a performer and somebody that we've wanted to talk with and meet for a long time. And it looks as if he's going to be a more regular presence here in Chicago, both as a soloist and as a recitalist, and that's a great thing, and we look forward to continuing the conversation with you over the years to come, and wish you all the best in your upcoming tours and other projects.
Well, thank you very much. Pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
The final variation and coda from Tchaikovsky's great A minor piano trio, Opus 50, Allegretto Risoluto e con Fuoco, and the coda Andante con Moto and Lugubre. And Lugubre on piano, of course, Yefim Bronfman, with Gil Shaham violin and Truls Merk cello, recorded just in 2006 at Queens College in Queens, New York, on Mr. Shaham's Canary Classics label. We opened our program, of course, with Islamé, Fantaisie Orientale, in the revised version of 1902 by Mili Balakirev, a piece that has more notes per measure than perhaps any other piece of its kind, as Tim Page and others have pointed out. Recorded somewhere I have long wanted to go, the Troy Savings Bank Music Hall in Troy, New York. Curious if any of you have ever been there, let me know. I've read about it, and it's just a fascinating artifact of American history, recorded there in Troy in 1998. We again remind you that Yefim Bronfman and Emmanuel Ax will be playing on two pianos on the same stage at the same time this Sunday, the 9th of November at 3 p.m. at Orchestra Hall as a part of the Great Performers series, music of Mozart, Rachmaninoff, the Haydn Variations of Brahms, and a recent work, Recuerdos, by William Bolcom. We'd like to thank Yefim Bronfman, Mark Van Bray, and Glenn Petrie for making our conversation with Mr. Bronfman possible. We'd like to thank Chris Willis for recording this interview in the bowels of the Orchestra Hall basement backstage area. We'd like to thank Matt DeStefano for making this program sound great, as is his wont, and we'd like to thank our funders, Alpha Wood Foundation and Draupner LLC, a Chicago-based private equity firm. Let us know what you thought about this or any of our other programs. Drop us a line at Rentap, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P, at AOL.com. And be sure to visit us online as well at WFMT.com/oneword critical thinking, where you can experience the critical thinking podcast. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.